I'll call to order the meeting of Sussex County Council for August 3rd, 2010. First item is the approval of the agenda. Mr. Baker, any changes?
I do have one suggested change. Under executive session, if we could strike personnel and pending litigation.
Make that motion.
Second, please. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Approval of the minutes in your packets this week were the minutes from July 22nd, 27th. If there are no changes, I'll consider the minutes approved. Reading of correspondence, Mr. Moore.
Yes, Mr. President. We have two letters. The first one is, dear participant, I'm writing on behalf of the Moms Club of Rehoboth Beach area, Delaware, to thank you for participating in our third annual Touch a Truck event. Due in part to your help and participation, I'm glad to say that Touch a Truck was a successful community event which raised over $7,000 for the March of Dimes. Despite the rain, over 1,500 people entered our event to see and touch 34 vehicles. Kind regards, Lisa Ashman, Moms Club of Rehoboth Beach area, Delaware, co-chair 2010 Touch a Truck. The other letter is dated July 5th, to whom it may concern. It's been my pleasure to use the Sussex County Airport for both business and pleasure the past few years. Yours is what an airport should be. The guys at Georgetown Air are the most professional and helpful in the business. They are an asset to Sussex County. And thank you for your good work. Mark E. Galbraith. Those are the only two letters, Mr. Phillips.
Council have any other correspondence?
No.
Not. We'll turn to Mr. Baker.
Good morning. The first item is an update on the Western Sussex Byway Project, and we have with us Mr. Dan Parsons, and he's going to provide us with an update.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We wanted to officially thank you for sponsorship of the Byway and show you a little production that we made to promote the Byway. We were going to present this at the Riverfest, but we got rained out. So we decided to present you with a proclamation from the governor thanking you for your sponsorship of the Byway. And just to let you know that we have applied for funds for the corridor management plan, and we should know by the fall whether or not we get the funding for that. And if we do, we continue on. If we don't, we wait another year and apply again, and then we have 2 to 5 years to come up with the corridor management plan, which again was the 14 points that we followed from the Federal Highway Administration in regards to the planning. And I guess we're going to share the video now or present the proclamation.
Go ahead and do the proclamation.
Okay. Well, with me I have Ms. Nesbitt. She's the chairperson of the Byway committee. And he's on the committee as well. And Mr. Earl Hall, Mr. Kendall Jones, Mr. Dave Hilkins, all members of the committee who helped put this all together.
So we thank the Sussex County Council for their support and assistance. And it says a lot of nice things about the County Council. But with the assistance and support of the Council, the route was granted the official designation from the Delaware Department of Transportation in March of 2010. This is giving us an opportunity to share the historic and cultural and scenic values of our area with the outside world. And we thank you very much for your support. And I give it to Vance, Dave, who?
Vance,
you get it. All right.
He's coming around. He's all right.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for all your effort.
I think they'd like a picture.
Sure.
They want a picture? All right.
Yeah. Yep. Let's do pictures first.
Yeah, this is primarily in your district.
I know who's it. Oh, good Lord.
Okay. Yeah, Mike.
I will get a picture of that.
I'm not sure I voted for it.
Oh, don't even try that.
I was thinking that.
I didn't even know until I asked him. Usually he makes a big production that he won't be here.
Where do you want us?
Must have snuck off in the night.
I did. Who's that in the back?
How you doing, Mr. Toll?
Step right up there, young man. Step right up there.
Hey, see you.
Well, Paul here, Molly Mack. Yep. Here we go. On three, ready?
Not a real professional.
Thank you all very much for your help in this, too.
Thank you for your help.
I'm sorry, man. Hang on, Vance's office.
Western Sussex Byway extends approximately 35 miles along several rural roads in western Sussex County. From the exit off US 13 onto US 13A through Seaford, across Woodland Ferry to Bethel, through to Laurel, crossing US 13 at Sycamore Road for a stop at Old Christ Church, with the final stop at Trap Pond State Park. The purpose of this road is to highlight the historic and natural beauty of the area, taking participants on a wonderful journey down rural back roads to view historic gems and beautiful natural vistas along the Nanticoke River and Broad Creek. Mr. Kendall Jones of Laurel, member of the Citizens Committee responsible for the byway, will take you on a tour of some of the highlights along the route. Hope you enjoy.
This is Hearn's Mill. It's the first stop on the Western Sussex Byway. It has been an operating mill here certainly from the 1870s, 80s probably. There was an earlier mill site here, but that burned, and this building, we think, is from 1880 or so. Source of water was what was needed for these mills, and if there was a source of water and a ravine, then the power from that waterfall could turn the turbines and the wheels that ground the mill. These mills were being constructed. The laws said that if you constructed a mill, you also had to build a roadway for passengers and animals to cross. And so with all of these mills in western Sussex, you'll find a road crossing at the mill site. In Laurel, there were 50 in a 13-mile radius by 1850. This is a home that was constructed by Governor William Henry Harrison Ross about 1860. He had traveled to Europe several times as a young man with his father and fell in love with this Italian-style architecture. He became a governor from Seaford for the state of Delaware, but he was born in Laurel. His father was Caleb Ross, a well-known merchant and landowner in the area. The house is now owned by the Seaford Historical Society and has been furnished with many of the Ross family furnishings. This is a slave quarters at the Ross Mansion. It's the only known Delaware housing for blacks at that time. As I say, he had 14 slaves. And did they all live here? Well, it would seem so. It's a story and a half structure, and it's in the yard beside the Ross Mansion. This is another old building on High Street in Seaford. This is known as Mount Olivet Church. Of course, there was a great Methodist revival period in the 1800s. It's an late 1800s building. And some members of the Hooper family, which the family first established what's now known as Seaford, are buried in the graveyard there by the church. This property began construction in 1939. This was for the production of this new product, which was named nylon. It was the very first manufacturing plant built for nylon. DuPont had discovered this product, and we're going to build a building somewhere at the time, according to Walter Carpenter, who was president. And since Laurel and Seaford both had water and they both had railroads, and they were the two things that DuPont needed for this new process, they went to Seaford and were received very well, and so the town became known as the nylon capital of the world. It employed up to 5,000 people over a period of years, and it helped not only the towns of Seaford and Laurel, but many of the communities around here, even over into Maryland, because it provided well-paid jobs for people that hadn't had an opportunity to do that before without furthering their education. The plan is now owned by Invista and probably employs maybe 100 people there. This is woodland on the Nanticoke River. There has been a ferry here since about 1740s. It was originally a privately owned ferry. Today it's part of the state highway system, and there is no cost for using this ferry, which takes you across the Nanticoke. Many people associate this area with Paddy Cannon, the notorious slave dealer, and her home was, there is a property here, but this was not Patty's home, but she did live nearby. Patty was a Canadian girl who had married a Seaford man by the name of Cannon as he visited Canada, became ill, and she and her family nursed him back to health, and she married him and came to this area. What Patty was doing was capturing freed slaves or freed blacks or for to anyone that she could capture and selling them into the South. She had a tavern a short distance from here, a little area called Reliance, and it was right on the Delaware-Maryland line. And even though new people knew what she was doing for years, they were never able to arrest her because if Maryland authorities came, she went into the Delaware section of the house and vice versa, and you couldn't pick up your telephone to call for backup. So Patty was running this area pretty much on her own terms for many years. It's said that she kept a boat out here in the Nanticoke and would put these captured people on the boat until she had a load to sell back into the South. Supposedly, when she was arrested, she did carry poison with her, or someone made it available to her in the prison, and so she did die in prison. Now, this is one of the popular ship carpenters' houses in the town of Bethel. This community was really originally known as Lewis Wharf or Lewis Landing, and it was established by Kendall Lewis in about 1840. This is a style of house that his shipbuilders were built for themselves. The fancier homes in the Victorian area, as you see, were really usually the captain's homes. But Bethel Street still have many of these small houses and lovely fences in Bethel. They became very well known for a ship that took the name of the Ram, the sailing rams. These were long, narrow boats. They were built that way so they could go through the canals. And when they hit the water, it said that the bow lifted. It was like a ram coming at you, and that's where the name came from. The Fuchs family were large farm owners, large property owners, very prosperous with their produce and farm work. And this is a thing, that kind of home that they could afford to give as a wedding gift. And this is what had happened to the area with the coming of the railroad and the improved transportation. We did become very prosperous. In 1885, the town of Laurel was said to be the wealthiest town in the state of Delaware. And now this portion of the town is the largest historic district in the state of Delaware. This is Laurel's museum, owned by the Laurel Historical Society. It was the home of Harold and Thelma Cook, as well as Mr. Cook's parents before him, and was donated to the society by their daughter. It contains many items and is furnished with Delaware furniture and memorabilia. It's open in the summer months every Sunday afternoon and open for special times. This property is known as Rosemont on Delaware Avenue. It was constructed by John Mitchell in 1700s, and it's at the top of a hill, if you can call that a hill, in this flat country of ours. But it overlooks the mill dam in Laurel, and that he built the first mill dam there by 1760. And from his home, he could look down on his work and his workers. The porch and the columns would have been added in the 1800s. It was a plain front house to begin with. His son Nathaniel was the first Laurel man to become a Delaware governor. He also served in the militia. He was a grandson of General Dagsworthy, who was an officer in the Revolution. And Nathaniel became a very prominent and caring Delaware man. Although we refer to this as Old Christ Church, the original name was Christ Church on Broad Creek. It was completed in 1772, and we were part of Maryland at the time. And so the local people petitioned the Maryland Assembly to build them a chapel of ease or a chapel of convenience, because it was a day's trip to travel down to the Wicomico River and Green Hill Church. It was built for all people, and all people were taxed by Stephanie Parish. And at the time it was built, records would indicate that there was a membership of maybe 475 people, but only 200 of them were members of the Church of England, which was the Church of the New World. It's built of heart pine. It's on Chipman's Pond. Here again, water was the easiest way for transportation and the easiest way to travel. They say they would come for services here on a Sunday and pull up their boats on the from the pond. It was known as Houston's Pond at that time. Robert Houston was the name of the builder and also the owner of the land. It has never had any paint except on the window frame and a preservative on the outside. Trapon State Park was the very first state park, and that was about 1952, I believe, when it was turned over to the state. This area, both Trap Pond and the neighboring Tressum Pond, is known to be the most northern spot that bald cypress grow on the eastern area. There was a mill dam here and also at Tressum, and the flood of 1933 washed both of those dams out. At that time, there was a program called the CCC program, the Civilian Conservation Corps. And this was a way for young men to have work and to have income. And this was one of those projects. And the CCC boys came to this area, bought up the land. The federal government had bought up the land, first of all. But they cleared it. They cleared part of the pond to create a swimming area free of stumps and debris. Made a few benches and a picnic area, and it's blossomed into what it is today.
We hope you enjoyed this tour of the Western Sussex Byway and invite you to explore and experience the history and culture of Western Sussex County.
Thank you. Very nice. Very good. Thank you very much. And hopefully you'll get the federal money to help you do that.
Mr. Baker?
The next item on the agenda is a proposal regarding our medical insurance program. We have a proposal for your consideration for a slight change to the program. And just to give you a little background about it, and I think Mr. Dave Smith is here, and I don't know if Bonnie Wooten's here or not, from the personnel department. There are a few instances of large medical costs incurred by some employees who have had severe medical problems to cope with since August 1st, 2009. And on that date, the county implemented a new policy regarding copays and deductibles for their plan. We currently have two plans, a gold plan, which is the more popular plan, which included as of August 1st, 2009, additional copays, but there were no out-of-pocket limits. And the new one of the new copays was for doctor visits within a hospital. For a small number of employees and their families who elected the gold plan and had the misfortune of major medical problems by their family, some have incurred major costs for copays. For employees whose covered family members have long-term hospital stays, each time a doctor visits a patient in the hospital, there is now a $20 copay for each visit. While for less serious cases, this is not a problem, for long-term hospital stays, these amounts can become rather large and difficult for the employee. In addition, there are $20 copays for each lab charge and x-rays. For long-term stays, this is compounded by the fact that there may be a loss of work time and pay for the employee and or spouse that affects their income. So prior to August 1st, 2009, we did not have a copay for hospital visits by doctor. Mr. Dave Smith from Integra has developed this proposal to establish an out-of-pocket limit for the gold plan for copays of $2,000 within the network for individual, $4,000 for family in the network, $4,000 for individual out-of-network, and $8,000 limit for families. And the proposal would be to make this change effective August 1st, 2010. The estimated cost to our plan would, for such a change, would be approximately $15,000 to $25,000. Again, that would be for the limited number of employees that it would apply to. The proposal was also to consider possibly reimbursing from the insurance plan those employees who incurred costs above these noted limits retroactively as of August 1st. The estimate for the cost of this proposal would be $9,000. This was reviewed with Mr. Steve Fallon, the county's medical insurance plan consultant, and he noted that such out-of-pocket limits are typical, about 20% of health insurance plans, and that the employee share of the cost of a major medical problem is still very small. And there are no other changes to be recommended here, and I'd like to ask Mr. Smith if he'd like to come up and make any comments.
Dave asked me if I would come and be available to answer any questions that you had, and I think you've had this proposal for a day or two to look it over. It was at a request from Denny Cordry, the Director of Personnel, and it was based on the fact that there was a number of people, not a large number, but a small number of people who had experienced severe out-of-pocket costs due to hospitalization charges for doctor visits. In a severe medical situation, you can have three, four, five doctors a day coming to visit you, pop in, say hello, how are you, and every time that was a $20 copay. So those individuals were seeing as high as $100 a day being out-of-pocket costs. This was not intended in the original design of the plan. The Silver Plan, for instance, has a 90% coinsurance with a maximum out-of-pocket of $2,000. So a person who would be on the Silver Plan under that same scenario would have had that out-of-pocket cost limited. So in analyzing the situation, we felt that it would be best to cap those costs on the Gold Plan as well. And I'm here to answer any other questions. I just wanted to give you...
So basically, they would still, as the doctors visited, they'd still be making the copays, but it would...
It would cap it at $2,000 an individual, $4,000 right. A family.
We're not doing away with any of that. Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm. Just to be improving that plan,
right,
to cap it at the same out-of-pocket cost as the Silver Plan, which is really the lower plan of benefits.
So the lower plan had a better deal...
It would have had a better deal under this particular circumstance, right, except that outpatient copays continue, and this caps copays both inpatient and outpatient at the $2,000 level.
And the annual cost of $15,000 to $25,000, Dave, is to the county budget?
To the group hospital plan, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's part of our budget, yes.
Right, right.
Could I ask a question, Mr. Smith? My understanding was with the silver plan, there would not be a cap on the copays.
There is no cap on the copays.
Okay, but there is on the...
Right. You have to remember, though, that when we're talking about in-hospital doctor visits, which is where this major problem had arisen, was that with the gold plan, there was no caps, but with the silver plan, there was a cap because the benefit was 90%. The employee would pay 10% up to the $2,000 out-of-pocket. Where the cap does not apply is on regular doctor visits for the silver plan. They would continue to pay their copays,
right.
X-ray and lab, those kind of things. They would continue to pay those copays once the out-of-pocket is met. The gold plan, it caps it entirely at $2,000. So it maintains that gold plan being much better than the silver, which is the way it was tended to be.
I guess you kind of hate to see the doctor show up when you're in the hospital.
Yeah, it really is a bad thing because, you know, they basically show up and sometimes they don't spend much time. They just stick their head in the door.
They just sort of whiz by, seems like,
that's
sometimes.
Right.
It seemed like this is the right thing to do. I mean, we should.
Yeah. And I don't think the council has a problem with us applying the retroactivity to
Absolutely
it.
Absolutely not.
I would hope not.
Okay,
good.
No.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Baker, do you have a motion?
Yes. Be it moved that the Sussex County Council approves a change to the county's gold medical insurance plan whereby individual out-of-pocket limits, including copays, would be established at $2,000 in-network and $4,000 for out-of-network. Family out-of-pocket limits, including copays, would be established at $4,000 in-network and $8,000 for out-of-network. These changes would be effective as of August 1st, 2009, to assist the small number of employees who have incurred major medical problems and large amounts of copay costs.
So moved.
Second.
Motion and a second to approve the change. Does that include the language for retroactivity?
Yes.
Okay.
August 1st, 2009.
Any further discussion?
Goes retroactive back to when?
August 1st, 2009.
Good.
Made the original change.
Good.
Any further discussion?
No.
We'll take the vote. Ms. Deaver?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
Mr. Cole?
Yes.
Mr. Vincent?
Yes.
I vote yes as well. Thank you for picking that up, Mr. Baker. It's an appropriate change.
Thank you. The next item we have is a discussion and possible introduction of the ordinances that recommended by the Manufactured Housing Committee. And we have three ordinances prepared by Mr. Moore's law firm for discussion and possible introduction. They are based on recommendations of the committee. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Lank to explain the ordinances.
Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Lank.
Just for a little short and real short history of the actions of the committee. The council established an ad hoc committee to discuss manufactured housing issues. The committee met three different times on February 4th, March 4th, and April 8th, and discussed the ordinances as they exist and as they would be suggested for amendment. On June 8th, the presentation was made to council for the purpose of showing to council what the committee had discussed. And since that time, Mr. Moore's office has been working on preparation of ordinances. They have been prepared in three different ordinances. I believe you all have copies. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. I'm assuming I have the same sequence, but the first one is an ordinance to amend Chapter 115 of the Code of Sussex County by amending Article 1 relating to definitions regarding manufactured homes. In that sense, as we do by ordinance, we bracket that information being removed or proposed to be removed, and underline that information that's proposed to be incorporated into the ordinance. The first one, relating to manufactured homes and relating to manufactured home parks, was the definition of an accessory building, and it's proposed to be rewritten as a detached, unattached, subordinate building, the use of which is incidental to or customarily found in connection with and except as otherwise provided in this chapter is located on the same lot as the main building or principal use of the land. An example of an accessory building may include a shed, storage building, a garage, a gazebo, or similar structure. Now, the second definition would basically to clarify or strike the word mobile home and house trailer and incorporate and proposed manufactured home, also known as house trailer, single wide, double wide, and mobile home. And in that definition, we have just changed a few words, and it would state a movable or portable dwelling, and we would delete the word over and incorporate not less than 450 square feet in size, constructed to be towed on its own chassis, connected to utilities, and designed with or, that's underlined for new wording, without a permanent foundation for year-round occupancy, which can consist of one or more components that can be retracted for towing purposes and subsequently expanded for additional capacity, or of two or more units separately towable but designed to be joined into one integral unit.
While you're there, can I ask a question? Right on this very paragraph, where it says for year-round occupancy, could we say instead to be occupied as a dwelling? Because year-round occupancy, they're occupied on a seasonal basis as well as year-round.
Well, it's placed permanently, so whether it's occupied year-round or whether it's occupied part-time, as in a lot of the seasonal park areas, it would basically be the same. They could still come down in the winter months if they so desired.
But it says year-round occupancy. In a rental house business or the rental business, so year-round means all year long.
Right, but it doesn't matter.
It doesn't say it has to be.
It just says that the unit has to be designed for year-round use, whether you use it a day or a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the word design will cover that.
Okay.
The next item was it originally stated trailer park, trailer court, or mobile home park, and we, to bring it up to standards, proposed it to be titled manufactured home park, also known as trailer park, trailer court, mobile home park, or community. And in that case, the wording is, again, a minor change, and it would state any tract of land used or offered for use of the location of, and we delete trailers or mobile homes, and then insert manufactured homes of other ownership to be occupied as dwellings. And then the last definition would be manufactured home, and that is existing in the flood area or flood districts, and it was a duplication of definition, so we would just strike that definition out because it's going to be replaced by the other previously read definition. And it's just in synopsis, the ordinance addresses the fact that there are three similar but different definitions of manufactured homes in the current code. The new definition with a new title would allow the code to be consistent throughout. The new definition of accessory building clarifies language as to exactly what is considered an accessory building and to specify that an accessory building is a detached structure. The new title and revised definition of trailer park to include manufactured home was done for consistency purposes in the code, and any text that is deleted is enclosed in brackets, and any text that is amended or added is underlined. And those, all the definitions contained in this ordinance are approved recommendations from the Manufactured Housing Committee.
I got a question for you. While we're working on these definitions, you know, a number of years ago we discussed that park model. Now, park models have gotten bigger and bigger. And
Now, I see this 450 square feet in size. If a park model is 450 square feet, would it fall in this definition? Because they're putting park models, which are like...
It doesn't fall into design for being built on a permanent foundation. And I don't think there's a park model that it meets the 450 square foot.
Well, they're getting two-story now.
Because they've got... some of the park models have been in the 340 range, maybe 380.
I don't know.
One that's over 400. And one of these proposals in these ordinances changes the square footage requirement for a manufactured house. But it was in a park allowed to be 400, and okay. We've increased it to 450.
I just a number of years ago got concerned when I saw what we thought were campgrounds right. being converted into miniature mobile home parks with these right. basically park models, which are seem to be permanent. They got porches and propane tanks and everything else.
Yeah, and some of the park models are difficult to. They are designed under camping codes, but they are also large, as you state,
oh, yeah.
and they almost met the requirements for a manufactured home.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if you wouldn't find somebody living in them year round nowadays.
But they're still considered a camper.
By the state, we could, in our code, we could address them, couldn't we, with a definition somehow?
We could, but we would have to amend and reference park models.
Not this section of the code.
In the camper section, so that they're specifically described.
Okay. I wouldn't mind reading.
Wouldn't be a bad idea.
No, I think that needs to be reviewed, yes. Okay. All right, well, go ahead. Yeah, that wouldn't fall in this area then. Okay.
Now, that was what I called number one from where they originally were submitted by Patrick Vandersloot.
So basically, we're now just making one definition is what you've done with this.
Right, but there were three locations that was referenced as two definitions, and we needed to bring it into one. And the wording that was done in the flood district was based on more current language at that time, and we didn't correct the first definition.
Okay.
That was the general definition, so this would bring them into the same. What I'll call number two is an ordinance to amend Chapter 115 of the Code of Sussex County by amending Article Roman Numeral 24, 115-172G, relating to conditional uses regarding manufactured homes. And under Section 1.
Mr. Lank, the council's way ours were attached, that was the last one.
Okay,
the
I'll one go back to read. The other one.
Okay, which one?
I'll call number two, number three now.
Okay.
Excuse me. I didn't have the packet.
I'm glad you knew where it was at because I was beginning to wonder.
The one that was second in the council packet was the one amending 115-187C.
That's right.
Okay.
And this was a really short ordinance proposal, and it basically, under 187C, in the zoning code, it states it shall have a gross floor area excluding any additions not a part of the original manufactured unit, not less than 450 square feet, and we've struck except in mobile home parks where the minimum will be 400 square feet. That means it's consistent throughout, whether it's a park or whether it's ag or GR. It still would be the same square footage as a minimum.
Okay.
And deletes out the 400. They don't make 400 square feet mobile homes anymore.
No. So,
probably don't make 450 square foot either, but they're still being utilized. And the purpose of that ordinance is to make the subsection of the code consistent with other portions of the code, again, at 450 square feet.
All right. So basically what we've done is housekeeping these two, right?
Right.
Okay.
Well, they're all basically housekeeping. Okay. We're going to bring them up to a standard that should be. For years, we've talked about taking out the words mobile home and trailer and using manufactured homes. That's what they're referred to as today. The last ordinance would be an ordinance to amend Article 24, Section 115-172G, the conditional use section, which relates to manufactured home parks. And the first section would be to amend the special requirements by deleting the sentence contained in 115-172G7, which reads, Steps with related landings not exceeding 28 square feet of lot coverage may project 4 feet into the required setback. And the purpose of that is to delete that because it's coming up in the new section, which is number 13 and 14. And we would add in the code that no part of an accessory building shall exceed, or excuse me, shall extend closer than 5 feet to the boundaries of an individual residential site, or within 20 feet to a main residential structure, or addition thereto on another residential site, or within 10 feet of an accessory building on another residential site, or exceed an overall height of 25 feet. An existing accessory building of the same dimension may be placed in the same location if the accessory building was previously permitted and if authorized by park management. Now, this relates specifically to the accessory buildings.
A shed.
Okay. Or whatever. Most of them are sheds.
Cetera.
Majority are sheds.
Okay, I'm just a
shed. And it still maintains a 20 foot from a main structure or addition thereto, but it allows the sheds to be 10 feet apart instead of 20.
And this means previously permitted by the county?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It could be replaced if previously permitted by the county.
Mm-hmm. Even if it didn't meet these other dimensions?
Right.
In other words, if there is one existing...
We discussed that back in June.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. No permits needed. They can replace it.
We need a permit.
Building permit.
Have a permit, but okay. It had to be a accessory building that was previously permitted, and it has to be authorized by department management to be replaced in the same location.
Okay. Or should we say park management or property owner?
It'd be the same.
Well, I'd right, but if...
Because we're dealing with it only in the mobile home, or excuse me, I said it wrong, all right, manufactured home parks. We're only dealing there. But if you get outside in the ag district or GR and anywhere else in the unincorporated area of the county that's not a mobile home park, then there's another set of rules.
Right.
It's only in the parks.
But, I mean, would it hurt to put in there or property owner, park management or property owner?
Well, it could be, but basically it's going to be the same because it's either the park management or else the property owner is going to have staff that's park management. Either way, it comes out the same, I think.
But now accessory buildings can be within 10 feet of each other.
Of each other.
Mm-hmm. But and they couldn't be before, could they?
Not supposed to be without a variance.
So that's loosening up the ordinance a bit. Okay.
And then number 14, which is new again, open unenclosed landings with steps or handicap ramps, providing access into the main residential structure may project 4 feet into the required side yard setback and the 20-foot separation requirement. An open unenclosed landing not exceeding 4 feet by 4 feet located near the elevation of the finished floor of the main residential structure shall have the necessary steps to get down from the landing to the grade of the lot. Open unenclosed landings and steps shall not be calculated as part of the 35% lot coverage requirement since they are required to provide access into the main residential structure. Handicap ramps may be permitted for emergency needs and shall be subject to the approval of park management, the director, and the county's chief of building code.
All three of them?
Right.
You need all three.
Because, well, if you take note, the reference was for emergency needs because in most cases they're temporary. And the ramp shall be designed and built to county building code and federal code guidelines relating to the Americans with Disabilities Act with specific slopes, handrails, et cetera.
So somebody just can't go out and build their own. I mean, they can go out and build their own, but they better meet a code.
What we found through some presentation at the committee and with discussion through the building code department that there have been some ramps built with no handrails, et cetera, that didn't meet the federal guidelines. There would be liability issues on all sides.
Does that require two inspectors besides a homeowner, park owner?
It would require an inspection by the county to make sure that it's built to code.
How about the emergency here?
Right, even for the emergency.
Is the county going to inspect it for an emergency?
Yeah, we'd have to.
Or would it be two individuals?
No, to establish the emergency.
Yeah.
It would have to be approved through the park management, myself, or whoever the director is, and the county's chief of building code, right?
Now, you know we're going to get a lot of complaints that that's going to be a very expensive ramp. Because if it meets those kind of guidelines, it's going to be
Well, you can't build what
it establishes is slope.
I don't know. I mean, it's the slope. You either come out of your house real fast or you come out slow.
Right.
You may not have, you may be jammed in because of a tree or something. People are building their own right now. They're just building a ramp. People are pushing them up, but I'm just saying, whenever you get federal guidelines or whatever, I can see that this is, going to be an expensive ramp compared to what we've been seeing people build. So,
Mr. Cole, however, all ramps are supposed to be built now under the federal guidelines, the ADA compliant. And during the discussions with the ad hoc committee, head of our building code department did testify that they have some pre-printed sheets which give all the specifications of those ramps. So if anyone comes in for emergency or otherwise, they can give that to them so they know how to calculate the slopes and the width.
I do see a difference here, George, and I kind of agree with you on what you're saying here.
Well, that'll be the complaint.
There is private homes here, and then there's public buildings. Federal emergency can come in here and say, well, you've got to have access to these buildings through ramps and all these other kind of ways. When you come to private homes, that's kind of difficult to tell someone just exactly what they got, what kind of ramp.
Well, I'm just saying this ordinance specifies that somebody building a ramp on their private home, but it's not on their private land. It's somebody else owns the land. That's a different ramp
If it meets the requirements of the management and requirements can understand the individual and says, well, I can understand your situation here, and an individual between that and the management, the guy actually owns the property.
Well, right now, people throughout this county have built ramps all shapes and sizes and with different types of railings and everything else. And I think they'll find that once this uniform type of, or this is handed to them, it's going to be very expensive. And that'll be the complaint. Now, I'm not saying we don't do it or something, but that'll be the complaint.
I understand. And I understand when you say individual, it's not like a federal building or a state building.
No, it's not a commercial building or a federal building.
And it's an individual for that individual's use.
I understand that.
And then try to meet their standards to a county building or federal building is certainly a different.
Right. But I don't know. I think with Everett's standards, there's no way we can get around it. Right, Everett, is what you're saying?
If we have any type of permitting, it has to be done in accordance with the ADA guidelines.
Even an individual home?
So the only way around it, Sam, would be that no permit would be required. If you did a no permit required, they could look like all kinds of things. Right.
When you build one for this county building or federal, that is permanent. Now, I know people that live 4 or 5 months and they're dead. You go out here and build this ramp just temporarily just to use it and get for that rest of their life. I can't see building things permanent for temporary people.
Well, there are temporary ramps too, and there's different organizations that organizations have been building temporary ramps. And I think there's certain service groups.
Yes.
But the building code had indicated that they're trying to make sure that they comply too, just so that if there's an ambulance service or anyone else that comes there, that they could get a stretcher out the door down the ramp, that the even the railings are wide enough so a stretcher would fit.
Well, the option would be, Sam, not to require a permit. Then you don't know what's going on anything could be built. So I don't know what's the worst case scenario. You make sure that they're into code and they're done properly, or we ignore it. Then they would be encroached. They could be encroaching, gone too far, gone too whatever. I don't know. So I just thought I'd bring it up. I think that'll be the complaint once we adopt something like this, that all of a sudden somebody finds out that they can't just build their own ramp anymore, which is probably what's been going on a lot.
That's nothing new, is it?
I think a lot of people have been just building ramps
for years
without permits. Wouldn't you say, Lawrence?
Some.
Yeah, there's some.
I don't know what percentage it might be.
Are they supposed to have a permit today?
Yeah, supposed to have a permit.
Okay.
The one thing that we noted in the discussion was that from building code, it would appear that some of the civic service organizations were actually building ramps, and those ramps may not have complied with code. Most of them didn't have handrails, for one.
Right.
And that became the concern.
Mm-hmm.
It's a safety issue, as Everett mentioned, if you bring in the paramedics or the EMT people, and they fall.
Right. Yeah, I'm not against. I'm not saying I'm against. I'm just saying that I just think we need to be aware that's going to be one of the major complaints with it.
They were building it without permit.
They were building them, and they would actually, most cases, some of those were temporary. They would take it, mm-hmm. build it, and they would take it to a certain site, place it, build a frame that would hold it, basically. They're probably not even under kind of foundation under it.
Right.
And then they would use it for 3 or 4 months until the hardship ceases, and they would come back and get it and
so
move on to another
site. So that's not a permit. No permit.
But they still need a permit, whether or without it being a temporary or not.
Okay. All right. I just thought I'd raise that issue.
Well, that's the basics of the three ordinances that are proposed for discussion purposes. And I would add one thing, and I've gone through the code again. We may have to create another ordinance. The word manufactured home, mobile home, trailer comes up so many times in the code. And you start looking through the code, and I found there's one full-page paragraph and under mobile home park section of the conditional use section that referenced trailers or mobiles 26 times. So we may need to have to talk to the legal and see if we really need to change it. The ordinances that are proposed, if they're adopted, may take care of that problem.
Yeah, because
we're
replacing,
we're saying manufactured home,
add.
And then it says AKA trailer or mobile, and it could take care of the problem.
Right.
I just need to show everything.
What was that question again? I'm sorry, Mr.
I say the ordinance in 115G under mobile home parks references the word trailer or mobile 26 times in a full page. And the reference to the definition, which changed it from manufactured home, AKA mobile or trailer, may take care of that problem.
So
without having
to change
all
everything.
The wording.
Right.
Otherwise, we change the wording through the whole ordinance, and we'd be probably changing.
Or could some wording be added that says that this now, you know, all past references such and such will be null and void and to be considered now as a such and such or so. Anyway, I'm sure we could.
But again,
add.
It doesn't have to be done today. It could be done in a separate ordinance if it's necessary.
Yeah, we could still introduce these by, we're going to have some other, I believe, house cleaning ordinances coming up. And in one of those, we could simply refer to that, all the other.
Make up basically the words, and as I said again, manufactured home definition now says, if it's approved, also known as trailer mobile home, then it might be taken care of already. I just need to.
Now, these are the only recommendations that we saw from the committee. I mean, the committee had some other issues. I'm just wondering, are we addressing any of these others, maybe, that
there
should
is,
be addressed?
There is at least one other pertaining to where variances, where when a variance for setbacks is approved for an improvement and an adjoining property improvement is later replaced, then that property is also required to get a variance.
Because of a neighbor's action.
Replaced. Yeah.
That doesn't seem fair.
So we were going to try to work something up. That was a little bit more complicated from the legal side, I think. And it's not one that would be particularly occur as a problem real often either. So,
okay.
Yes, but there will be other ordinances coming from this.
From this committee?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And could you highlight some of those other issues so we don't make sure that anybody out there listening might see what's coming down the pike?
Okay.
I mean, is this something we want to do today or?
Probably not today. I'd want to look at what they are and give counsel what those were.
Mr. Lang, but it's safe to say this isn't the end of it.
No.
The one of the big ones was what David referenced, or Mr. Baker referenced.
Right.
I have a question.
And that seemed to be a legal issue we had to work out.
Number 14 about the handicap ramps, it's also about all landings and steps and ramps. What was the reason for this? What brought this up? What was the problem?
Again, discussion through the committee and issues that we've seen through staff and building code.
What was happening?
The ordinance allows you to encroach. The one thing is the encroachment. It's 4 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Made reference to 28 square foot. It didn't make reference to anything larger, and that issue became effective and a problem when we went into flood zones where the elevation of the unit had to be higher.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had the landing of a certain size and the steps, you were going to exceed 28 square feet.
Okay.
And one of the points was that 28 square foot wasn't enough.
Okay.
And then the other issue, the ramp became the same issue. To get down to grade with a ramp, as George said earlier, you could really roll down a ramp, or you could mm-hmm. be safely rolled down a ramp.
Okay.
Then it had to be. It would be a larger, and would exceed by a substantial amount, 28 square foot.
Okay.
So we had to reference ramp also.
Okay.
And we're trying to address the emergency issue also at the same time.
Mr. Baker, what is our next step with these three ordinances?
The introduction would be the first step. If the council would like them introduced or introduce them, then we would hold public hearings. Planning and Zoning Commission would also hold public hearings.
Okay.
So we would schedule that.
Typically on an ordinance, it takes about 10 weeks to get to the council public hearing, because we have to introduce, and then we have to schedule, and we're already scheduled up through to the middle of September.
Right.
So then it would be probably late September for commission, and then early October for council.
Well, so we assume it
works out about 8 or 10 weeks.
Them. Yeah.
Right. Mrs. Deaver, introduce ordinances.
Yes.
All three.
Yes, all three.
And okay. We are working on this fourth one.
Yes.
Yep. And then you say, and then there's even maybe others.
Yes.
Okay, good. Maybe
because
some.
One of the things we want to look at also, if there's an additional house cleaning bill as a result of what Mr. Lank had mentioned earlier.
Could I make a request while we're doing some of this stuff? And maybe this is a good time to do it, because a lot of things have slowed up here. But what we referenced here about the park models and campgrounds, that relationship, that is an awkward relationship. Anybody not familiar with it, it'd be a good way to get educated about what's happening in some of these campgrounds. If you know it, I don't know if anybody's familiar with it, but Lawrence, if you could put it maybe on one of our agendas, and David, and
we'll make some contacts and see what the real sizes are.
Right, and get some pictures. So really get some pictures and show them what's happening. It's just because there are park models that have phone service, cable TV, and these are campgrounds that are supposed to be real portable. And I wouldn't be surprised.
But that's the typical campground, George. The most of the campgrounds now have got
it's
cable, telephone,
it may be typical here because
everything.
Just
it's all there.
We permitted it, or the state of Delaware said it was a camper, and we just said okay. I know in other locations they don't consider a park model a camp.
The only place where we have a little bit more control is within the flood districts. Or flood zones, because the
you can't pull those things out and ride down the road.
They can't stay in the park more than so many days.
Right, but you can't pull those things just out. You got special permits. You got all kinds of stuff. They do
typically a park model's not.
And they're two story now. They got pop outs, and I mean it's a new animal, and I don't think we're looking at it. It's taking campgrounds and turning them into basically mobile home parks, which is again something that they're not really not to say this word, but they're not helping with paramedics. They're not helping with a lot of
not paying property taxes.
They're not picking up the tab on anything. Where mobile home parks are participating in the good life here in Sussex County. So.
Okay, we'll move right along.
What about these double wides coming into the single wide lots? Is there any kind of ordinances proposed to stop that, or
only the square footage?
Only the square footage.
35%.
Mm-hmm.
Is supposed to cover that issue.
Mm-hmm.
It'll limit their square footage. It'll limit their expansion or addition and accessory building.
Because people
want to get to a certain square footage, they're done unless they apply for a variance.
That's handled.
Had to be a public hearing
at the board of adjustment level. Okay.
Thank you, Lawrence. Mr. Report, Mr. Baker.
Hey, Georgetown Public Library. The new Georgetown Public Library is now open. The new building at 123 West Pine Street has 29,490 square feet compared to their previous location of approximately 2,000 square feet. We wish to congratulate the Georgetown Public Library Board and the many individuals who helped with fundraising for this project. Dennis V. Cordry, Director of Personnel. Dennis Cordry, Director of Personnel since 1980, will retire effective Friday, August 6, 2010. He has served Sussex County government for 33 years and was a zoning inspector in the county's P&Z department prior to his promotion to Director of Personnel. Personnel department handles payroll requests, oversees medical and other personnel benefits, and assists employees that have concerns. County tax bills. The Treasury Department began mailing tax bills yesterday, Monday, August 2nd. These bills include property taxes for 8 school districts in the county, county property tax, county library tax, county water and sewer district, front foot assessments for some districts, ditch taxes, and capitation taxes. The county tax portion of the property tax bills represents a low of 10.1% for the Milford School District to a high of 13.9% for the Laurel School District. Payment is due September 30. The bills total approximately $101 million. Penalty of 1.5% per month is charged after September 30. This year, again, for the second time, bills will not be mailed to property owners. Rather, taxes paid via an escrow account through their bank or mortgage company. This will, again, save approximately $22,000 in mailing costs. Please contact the Treasury Division if you have any questions, 855-7760. Substantial completion. The Engineering Department granted substantial completion to Windhurst Manor Phase 4, the developer's Millville Associates, LLC, and it's part of the Millville Expansion and Bethany Sewer District, today. Consisting of 7 attached multifamily units. Thank you.
That's me.
That's you.
Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. Mr. Godwin.
Mr. Vice President, members of council, this morning we have one wastewater agreement for your consideration. This is Sussex County project number 81-04, Longneck Shores, part of phase 3, Timber Creek Lane agreement number 820-2. The developer in this case is Mr. Gary McCray of Lewis, Delaware. The location we're discussing is Sussex County Road 299, and it'll be part of the Longneck Sanitary Sewer District, serving 36 single-family and age-restricted dwellings. The total sewer connection charges come to $124,992. We do have approvals from our engineering department as well as the Department of Natural Resources. We're expecting 15 days of construction time with a construction administration and construction inspection costs totaling $5,058.90, with a proposed construction cost of $33,726. I have a motion for your consideration.
Thank you.
Be it moved that based upon the recommendation of the Sussex County Engineering Department for a Sussex County project number 81-04, agreement number 820-2, that the Sussex County Council execute a construction administration and construction inspection agreement between Sussex County Council and Dyer McCray Ventures, LLC, for wastewater facilities to be constructed in Longneck Shores, part of Phase 3, Timber Creek Lane, located in the Longneck Sanitary Sewer District.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any questions on the motion? All right, we'll take the vote. Mrs. Deaver?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
Mr. Cole?
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Hicken.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have two items this morning. The first one, I hope, is just a formality. It's a lease extension with the LifeNet folks. Actually, the lease is in the name of Air Methods Corporation, who owns Rocky Mountain Holdings, LLC, who operates here as LifeNet, but we just call them LifeNet. LifeNet operates an air ambulance service under contract with Christiana Care, and they also provide backup support to the state police and medical evacuations. They're at the end of their initial 3-year term for their lease, which will expire at the end of next month. The lease allows for 3 additional, and I think I put 2 in your package, but it is 3 additional 3-year extension options. They've requested to exercise the first one, and under the lease, the county has 30 days to respond to that. This is one of our success stories out there. We had the property appraised 3 years ago when we went through the initial negotiation. The property appraised for $18,000 a year in rent. And the property includes the lot and the county-owned hangar. It was about 3,600 square feet. LifeNet pays $18,000 a year. There's an increase of 3% with each option, so the new rent's going to be $18,540. There's about 15 to 20 jobs that are provided out there. a regular basis, and they buy a lot of fuel. They've purchased 54,000 gallons of fuel in the last 2.5 years, to which the county collects a fuel flowage fee of 8 cents a gallon. So that's about $4,300 in revenue that we've gotten from that operation. But unless you have any questions, I have a motion.
Any questions?
No.
Good job.
Read the motion, sir.
It moved that the Sussex County Council approve the first extension to the lease agreement with Air Methods Corporation for Lot A2 at the Sussex County Airport, dated 5 September 2007.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any questions on the motion? Not. We'll take the vote. Mrs. Deaver?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried.
Good news.
Good job.
Very good.
Next thing, sir.
Next one's probably not as much of a formality. This is a contract amendment with Delta Airport Consultants to conduct an environmental assessment for our proposed 500-foot runway extension at the airport. As you recall, our plan has always been to extend the runway by 1,000 feet. And as part of that process, we had conducted an environmental assessment on that project. And the FAA has not accepted that because we're not able to justify the 1,000-foot requirement anymore. However, we can justify a 500-foot extension, and that is our new plan, along with the FAA's plan. However, the environmental assessment that was completed does not apply to this project. So, you know, under federal laws, we have to do it, and it's completely separate environmental assessment for this project. And we can use portions of the environmental assessment that we've already done, and we're going to do that as much as possible. However, the part that's left with Delta's proposal is going to cost $229,247 for this contract amendment. We've already been notified that we will get a 95% grant for this project.
Oh, good.
And we should be getting the paperwork on that in the next week or so, but the money's been released.
Good.
We did everything we could to reduce the scope of work on this. You know, we kind of thought it was silly that, you know, if 1,000 feet is good enough, you know, why isn't 500 feet? But like I said, the federal laws require us to do a specific environmental assessment for this project.
Unbelievable.
It's certainly, and I know you know what you can do. I understand that, and I commend you for that. I know we wrote letters to our congressional delegation and asked them for help. But, you know, it truly is $229,000 of wasted taxpayer money, federal taxpayer money, to do this. It's crazy. But we have no options, obviously. So
It is. But, you know, some of it needs to be done. For instance, you don't know what the impacts are unless you design do a little bit of preliminary design of the project. Part of the specific impact categories is noise, and there are some legal issues there, where, you know, up to certain decibel levels, we're required to own that property, and we need to identify where those lines are. You know, beyond that, to another decibel level, the local residents can claim a problem with noise and be reimbursed for noise abatement activities at their house, new windows and things like that. So there are some things that, you know, you just can't say if you're okay before, you're okay now. They need to know where that line is.
It's hard to believe that noise at 1,000 feet is going to be more than 500 feet.
Right. And part of that is the mix of aircraft has changed, so we don't know. You can't just cut that line in half anymore, you know, and with the different size of runway, the locations are different. So the noise model has to be run again.
We're putting an extension on the very same end, right?
Yep.
That's
correct. I mean, we're covering the very same ground, except we're only going to cover half. Mm-hmm. So I don't really see where the difference comes in here. I just can't understand this. This is just beyond. I think this is a total waste of dumb, stupid people out here. Can't understand environmental issues and come out and spend my money like this is just crazy. Just crazy. It's unexcusable.
I think we all agree.
Sam, you sound like you're upset this morning.
I am upset to waste money like this.
Any more questions, Mr. Higgins?
Well, in November, maybe you can do something.
Do you have a motion, sir?
Sure.
And what we're going to pay out of this thing is $5,993.
Correct. Be it moved, based upon the recommendation of the Sussex County Engineering Department, that the Sussex County Council approves Amendment Number 25 to the Engineering Agreement between Sussex County and Delta Airport Consultants, Inc., to conduct Runway 422 Extension Environmental Assessment for the Sussex County Airport, which increases the original contract amount by no more than $229,247, pending approval from the County Finance Director and receipt of a federal grant.
We have a motion.
So moved.
We have a motion to have a move, and we have a second.
Second.
Second, Mrs. Deaver. Any questions on a motion? We'll take the vote, Mrs. Deaver.
Yes.
Mr. Wilson.
Yes.
Cole.
Yes.
I vote yes, motion carried. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Poor Sam will be up. Sam, you're going to be upset the rest of the day.
Mr. Frank Shade.
There's Frank Shade.
You're right. It's just crazy.
You're right. No, you're right. It's just on my way.
Good morning.
Morning, sir. How are you?
It is still morning. I'm here this morning to discuss with you a proposal that was in your packets on